All right, the market is still trying to get a handle on how many interest rate hikes we may get from the Federal Reserve this year. Our next guest, though, thinks we will get 7 rate hikes this year. Joining us now is Bank of America Head of Global Economics, Ethan Harris. Ethan, good to speak with you here. This note from you and your team certainly getting a lot of attention out there in the street. What is the biggest factor behind you and your team moving to 7 rate hikes for this year?
Well, I think it's important to understand that the Fed is a bit behind the curve here. Normally, at this stage of the cycle, the Fed would have already hiked 100 or 150 basis points, and they would still be hiking as I speak. And what's happened, I think, at the Fed is last fall, they decided, okay, we're going to wait until we're absolutely certain that this is a serious inflation acceleration, absolutely certain that the labor market's going to remain strong. Now they've shifted gears. And so what we're calling for is not at all radical. We're saying they're going to hike 25 basis points at the next 7 meetings, by the end of the year, get close to 2% on the funds rate. It sounds very radical because investors have gotten used to a Fed that's always very friendly. But when you have inflation, the Fed's got to shift gears, and they're beginning to do that.
Ethan, it's Julie here. I guess what I'm not quite understanding in this call is you're also cutting your GDP growth forecast to 3.6%. And so you have the Fed consistently raising rates as the economy, it's not slowing, but the rate of growth is slowing. And won't that also slowing growth sort of take care of some of the inflation on its own? So put all this together for me.
Yeah. So, slower growth on its own doesn't contain inflation, because the growth we're talking about, 3.6% this year, will mean continued tightening of conditions in the economy. This imbalance we have right now with limited supply and strong demand is partly a supply story, but it's also a demand story. Demand is extremely strong, and we're likely to see a continued drop in the unemployment rate and other measures of spare capacity. We think the unemployment rate will hit 3% by the end of the year. So even with the slower growth, the Fed has to think about where we are a year from now. And a year from now, we're going to be in an environment where inflation's still a problem, that it hasn't completely gone away. And it's simply not appropriate to have near zero interest rates when you have inflation of 2.5% or 3% or wherever we're going to end up a year or two from now.
Ethan, what do you think, if we do in fact get these 7 rate hikes this year, what do you think that does to consumer spending and household wealth?
Well, it's a dent in the economy, right? And again, you can't fight inflation without any pain at all. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, if you don't impose any restraint on the economy, why would inflation come down at all? So the Fed has to impose some constraint on the economy, but it's against a backdrop of an economy with tremendous momentum. The household sector has easily record net worth as a share of income. If you add up their homes, their stock portfolio, their massive liquid savings in banks, households have $4 trillion in above normal bank deposits and money market funds right now. All that money they couldn't spend in the last 2 years is just piling up in their bank accounts. And so the fundamental backdrop for the consumer is extremely strong. And while I do think that the stock market's going to be constrained by this Fed policy, we've already seen a correction in the equity market, the outlook for the consumer is still pretty good. We don't really think the Fed starts to have an impact on the economy until the end of this year and into next year, after cumulative hikes start to put some real restraint on activity.
Ethan, this all raises a question that I've had pretty consistently during this inflation cycle, which is how much of what is going on is because of low rates and how much of it is because of constrained supply in various ways. So, if there has been this outlook that the supply side of it is going to work itself out eventually, how eventually is up for debate. But, what happens when that supply situation is taken care of and the Fed is raising rates?
Yeah, I grew up in a big family, and my mom used to say it takes two to tangle. It's both sides of the equation are at fault here. And, I had a lot of fights with my brothers, to be honest. So the story right now, it's a mixture of things. There's certainly the COVID shock has constrained supply. I mean, it really has caused a big pullback in the labor market, and that's creating some of this inflation pressure. But we can't completely ignore the demand side. You have the most aggressive fiscal policy in history that has left households flush with wealth and liquidity. Now, of course, the fiscal policy is starting to go away, but the liquidity and wealth is still there. And you have a central bank with a zero funds rate. So the Fed's job is can't control the supply side of the economy, but they can put a little bit of constraint into demand. And that's what they need to start doing. So I don't view hiking interest rates, you know, 175 basis points, 1.75% over the course of this year as being a body blow to the economy. I view it as a leaning against the inflation pressure. And inflation is going to come down partly on its own as imbalances in the economy ease. But the Fed has a role in that, too. They can't step back and say, it's not our fault. We have nothing to do with this. They have to do their share, which is put a little bit of restraint on the economy and recognize that some of this inflation is permanent, not just a temporary supply shock.
Ethan, real quickly before we let you go, if we're sitting here at this point next year and we get those 7 rate hikes, do you think the stock market will have been positive for this year?
I think it's kind of a flattish market, to be honest. I'll fudge a little on that. I'm not sure. I mean, I think that for now, we've had the near-term correction as the markets had to deal with the fact that the Fed isn't going to be completely friendly going forward. I mean, last fall, the Fed said, don't worry about inflation and don't worry about us. And they really helped drive the stock market. Now they're taking back that promise. But I think the market will do okay. I don't think it'll be a great year, be more of a flattish year.
Duly noted. All right, we'll leave it there. Ethan Harris, Bank of America, Head of Global Economics. We'll talk to you soon. All right, from jobs back to markets, the hype is giving way to reality when it comes to the SPAC market. Shares of many companies that came public via SPAC last year remain under pressure this year as investors sour on loss-making startups. So what's next for the SPAC space? Joining us now is Muddy Waters Research Founder Carson Block. Yahoo Finance's Akiko Fujita is here as well. Carson, always nice to get some time with you. Help us understand this pressure we continue to see on the SPAC market. Why that loss of investor appetite?
Well, I mean, obviously, we've got broad dynamics that have impacted this to some extent, right, which are the rise in interest rates leads to a sell-off in speculative assets. But I think structurally, the problem with SPACs, and over the long term, maybe a few of them will turn out to be reasonable investments. The structural problem, though, is you're generally giving 20% of the company away to the SPAC promoter. So these are not designed really to create wealth structurally. They're designed more to transfer wealth. And so the incentives to put a SPAC together are very strong to just do something, just close some transaction, and then you as the SPAC promoter get hundreds of millions of dollars in your pocket and you can sell out of that. So that, I think, is the structural issue that's really been, you know, like been catching up, or the chickens that have been coming home to roost here. The other thing that pushed it along was the SEC publicly stating that, okay, you actually, as SPAC promoters, you know, you previously assumed that you could make whatever public projections you wanted that, you know, could have really little connection to reality. So the SEC said, in actuality, you might be liable for that. Now, that's a legal gray area, but that also dialed back the willingness of company managements and SPAC promoters to get out there and, you know, tell these fairy tales about, you know, like sales growing 700 times in 5 years.
Carson, on that front, I mean, you've kind of been raising the red flag since spring of last year when we really started to see the peak of the SPAC boom. You've particularly been focused on SPACs in the EV space, saying essentially, and I'm paraphrasing here, that they're preying on retail investors. When you look at names out there, you know, like a Lucid, like a Lordstown, Nikola, I mean, are there any in particular that you think are especially egregious?
I mean, Lordstown and Nikola. I think it's a really interesting commentary on where we are today, that these companies, which, I mean, the businesses, and I haven't looked at them, you know, in any detail to be clear, but, you know, I think there's a good chance that these businesses are essentially close to valueless when all is said and done. Yet there's still real market cap there. And so I've taken to joking for a little while that 700 million is the new zero. But, you know, when you look at those companies, the new zero is actually, you know, multiple billions. So there's still a lot of froth there. And I think one of the things that it's a really interesting behavioral finance phenomenon that it's similar to negotiations, right? Studies show that if you're the first to try to frame a price or frame deal terms, it kind of anchors the discussions there. And when these companies have gone public with market caps that are enormous, it seems like, you know, there's this sense that as they shrink, even though the market caps are still way too big for these businesses, there's this attitude that like, well, they started out this big and now they're only this, so this is probably okay. It's probably a value. So I don't know. I think in future years, behavioral economists are going to have like a field day analyzing this period of time.
Carson, it's Julie here. There have been so many SPACs or companies that have been public over this method over the last year. I should say there have been so many de-SPACs perhaps. In and of itself, is the fact that a company chooses to come public that method a warning sign, all else being equal? In other words, you know, do you sort of not invest in these out of hand and look to IPOs and direct listings, for example, if you want a new listing?
Well, look, I mean, there certainly has been a track record of IPOs that haven't been great either, but the SPAC process is a much lighter touch way for a company to go public. Now, you can't look at it and say, per se, every company that's gone public via SPAC is uninvestable because it's gone public via SPAC. But if you're going to look at probabilities, the probabilities are much higher that something that went public via SPAC versus IPO should be deemed uninvestable.
Carson, specifically on the SEC, obviously they're reviewing the structure of these SPACs. You know, we've heard Gary Gensler talk more about the need for transparency. And I wonder if you think that really is the issue here. Is it the structure of these deals, or is it the fact that investors don't often really know what they're putting their money behind?
Well, I think it's all of the above. But I guess when we look at things structurally and what the legal framework had been assumed, you know, what the assumption was as to the legal framework there, there are two points to make. So first of all, the structure. Again, the SPAC promoter is going to get usually 20%. So I'm friendly with somebody who is a major shareholder in a company that did go public via SPAC, and it was actually a real business. And the SPAC promoter is a SPAC promoter that's been successful in doing SPACs. That SPAC promoter told the shareholders, the major shareholders, said, look, I don't care what I pay for this business, okay? I'm going to get my shares and I'm going to blow out of them. So you tell me how much we pay and we'll do it. And so that's the perverse incentive that structure creates. So that's number one. Number two, if you're going to bring a company public via IPO, you're generally not allowed to make projections of future results. That's called conditioning the market. That's prohibited. Now, with the SPACs, though, because it's not an IPO, the company already went public, it's an acquisition of a business, they've made these projections that really have almost no basis in reality. And so I think for a lot of investors who were, you know, especially the new retail investors who came in the market post-COVID, I think that they didn't understand that you really can't trust this. So when the company is coming out and saying, yeah, we did $7 million in revenue last year, in 5 years we'll be doing $1.4 billion, or that's our projection, they didn't know enough to be skeptical of that. So I think that issue, and that's what the SEC has tried to address, has tried to say, you know what, you don't have carte blanche to just throw predictions out there that have no basis in reality. So that kind of dialed back the hype that's surrounded a number of these de-SPAC transactions.
Carson, I want to bring it back to what you do. And I wonder if you have current short positions or short recommendations on any SPACs that we don't know about already.
I don't announce shorts until we're ready to announce shorts and generally releasing research. But we've closed out nicely. The SPACs that we had publicly shorted. So we've been happy with that. Although in retrospect, we were a little bit early to close out. But since you never have a crystal ball on where the market's going, I'm not going to cry over that.
Carson, I think the last time we spoke, we were talking about the risk of investing in Chinese stocks, particularly those listed in the U.S. Obviously, you were early to raise the concerns around Luckin Coffee as well. When you look at the landscape right now, is there a case for investing in Chinese companies, or is the risk just simply too high?
So I guess when people ask me about, should I invest in China? The answer that I give is, look, stocks go up if there are more buyers than sellers. So will there be a point in the near future in which massive allocators of massive pools of money say, hey, China's GDP is expected to grow, blah, blah, blah. Of course, nobody believes the GDP numbers, but that gets ignored in these conversations. It's expected to go blah, blah, blah. Let's increase our allocation to China equities to this. And, then you've got money flowing into the space. Plus, you have the passive flows into it. So those can push stocks up. Now, regardless of the quality of the numbers and the quality of the companies. Now, I guess what I would say to people who think that they should be long China for that reason, the risk that you get is overnight, without warning, the government pulls the rug out from underneath the companies in which you're invested. And we saw that a decent bit last year. And that's the nature of the system. That is a system that encourages fraud on a widespread basis. But that system in which there's really very little rule of law and there's no accountability to U.S. regulators effectively, that system can just blindside you all of a sudden. So that's what I would say is, go in eyes wide open, and maybe it works for the next however many years. But you have to understand that there's a risk. You're going to wake up and you're going to be in tears over these stocks that you're still owning. So if you can live with that and you think that there are going to be flows of funds into China equities, then maybe you should go along.
Well said. Muddy Waters Research founder Carson Block, always nice to get some time with you. Yahoo Finance's Akiko Fujita, good to see you as well.
Well, as mentioned, there's a lot of focus on Capitol Hill this week, especially with some nominations for some key positions at the Federal Reserve, the nation's central bank. So let's talk with one of those key policymakers on Capitol Hill, Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, also the chair of the Senate Banking Committee, joining us live on Yahoo Finance this afternoon. Senator Brown, it's great to have you on the program. There's the big hearing for three Fed governor nominees on Thursday, Lisa Cook, Philip Jefferson, and Sarah Bloom Raskin. And the last name is very important for that vice chair of supervision role, arguably the most important bank regulatory position in the land. But it seems like there's some questions about how aggressive she may be on the Federal Reserve's policing of climate risks in the financial industry. Just wondering if you expect that hearing later on this week to be a bit contentious.
Well, it will be contentious, even though these are three of the most qualified people ever nominated for the Federal Reserve, even though this will be the first time that in almost a decade where the entire Board of Governors, the entire seven-member board, will be seated. President Trump never really made much effort to fill out the complement, and President Biden is. But what she looks at it as an economic issue, the same way that Chair Powell does, and the Republican members of my committee and the Senate as a whole generally love Chair Powell. He's said that we need to move on climate. We need to roll in risk and understand and assess risk brought on by climate. So whether it's lending to businesses or whether it's lending to someone to buy a home and that's in a floodplain. All those issues are something that banks need to consider more fully than they have. That's what Chair Powell wants to do. It started to do. That's what the future Vice Chair Raskin wants to do as a Fed Vice Chair of Supervision, as a Fed Governor.
Senator, we've seen also some of the Republican talking points that they plan on bringing up on Thursday with regards to the other nominees as well, specifically Lisa Cook, the professor from Michigan State. They're kind of trying to tee up, I guess, maybe some scrutiny on her qualifications and her resume on specifically monetary policy. But at the same time, I guess I'm just wondering at large, the Democrats have the majority in the Senate. It's a thin one. But is there any reason to think that either Lisa Cook or any of these nominees are in danger of not making it all the way through confirmation?
No, we're going to confirm all three of them. I would assume almost all of them will get a significant number of Republican votes in the end. With Lisa Cook, she doesn't teach at an East Coast Ivy League school. And that bothers the sort of elitists in the Republican Party, that they want Ivy League. They don't even care if they're economists, Ivy League lawyers. She's a PhD in economics, not nearly everybody in that board, including Chair Powell. And I will vote for Chair Powell. I voted for him when Trump nominated him. I voted for him when Obama nominated him. I support him. Nobody says he's less than qualified, but she has a PhD in economics. He doesn't. I mean, these are very qualified. I'm sure that some Republicans are bothered because this is going to be a diverse board. In the history of the Fed, there's only been three African-American men on the Fed board out of seven seats over 100 plus years. Professor Jefferson will be the fourth man. Professor Cook will be the first Black woman. So this board will be diverse. It will be more diverse in its thinking. They have great expertise in study of poverty and study of race in labor issues, especially. And I like those voices on the board. So we will have a diverse board in gender and race, but equally important, we'll have a diverse board in terms of life experience as outlook and emphases. So I'm thrilled about this. The president made three really good appointments. We will finally fill out the seven-member board again for the first time in a decade. And if we're going to fight inflation the way the Fed needs to, you need all seven people in place. And that's why I'm going to work to get these done as fast as we can.
Senator Brown, it's Akiko here. Good to have you on again. Want to pivot here to another issue that you've been obviously leading on, which is this move to ban stock trading among lawmakers. It feels like there's a lot of momentum here from both parties. I know you introduced a bill last year, but we recently had Senator Mark Kelly on, who said that it's not enough to ban stock trading among lawmakers and staffers. It's got to extend to family members as well. Is that something you'd be on board with?
Yeah, I've been on board with that. I first introduced this bill as an amendment and then joined Senator Merkley on a bill almost a decade ago. The Congress passed a pretty weak bill that kind of required reporting, but too many members of the Senate trade in stocks and their spouses do. And I don't accuse anybody individually of a conflict of interest in betraying the public interest, but the temptation, if you own shares of stock, everything looks like a conflict of interest because we vote on everything in the Senate. We vote on banking rules. We vote on environmental rules. We vote on labor rules. We vote on wages, sometimes minimal. So there are all kinds of conflicts, and we need to write the strongest bill that we can get a majority of senators on. And it will be a challenge because a number of senators, especially Republicans, have complained about this. And there are a lot of people in the Senate that hold a lot of investments. And I'm concerned. I'm also concerned, don't forget, about the Federal Reserve. We know about some compromise, if you will. I was almost going to say betrayal of public trust. I'm not sure I'm going to go there. But we've had Fed presidents around the country. A couple resigned probably because of this. They were doing stock trading. There was a senator from Georgia. One of the reasons, the unwritten story, really, of one of the senators from Georgia that Senator Ossoff beat and gave the Democrats majority in the special election in early, or the runoff in early 2021, He traded made thousands of trades while a member of the Senate, buying and selling, and the other senator incumbent who also lost did some significant dumping of stocks. And that's just, I mean, you're here for public service, not here to enrich your portfolio. If you want to make more money, stay out of it. Don't run for the Senate, do something else. And I just think we have a public trust here.
Senator, you mentioned Republican senators that are kind of opposed to this move. But if you look over to the House, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has come out publicly and said, look, it's a free market. It's very well known in terms of the trades that her husband conducts as well. He's got quite a following. So I wonder what you think the compromise is going to look like. It feels like there's an agreement that something needs to be done, but the extent of the ban seems to still be in contention.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to negotiate here. I'm meeting today with a number of people that support this, and we will work to get something significant through the Senate. It won't be exactly the bill the way that I introduced it, or Senator Ossoff or Senator Merkley, but we need to move, and we need to include the Federal Reserve in it, and we need to include not all family members. I mean, not grown children, but we need to include spouses in these rules.
And Senator Brown, lastly, there's a number of hearings that you have on the docket in the Senate Banking Committee. Interesting to caught my eye. There's going to be a hearing on stablecoins with regards to the President Working Group report on that. That hearing will be happening February 15th, I believe it is. What are you hoping to glean in that hearing? And what is the next steps in terms of a possible legislation down the line for how the Congress might want to regulate that space?
Well, first, many of them are operating as financial institutions, but without coming in under the rules. So we want them to explain why they, number one, why they aren't under consumer protections or investor protections. And we also want them to explain why they're not a risk to the financial system as a whole. This place, what this place has done with bailing out the banks is pretty has turned a lot of people off from politics generally, and I don't want crypto to get in the same position. So right now, though, there are a number of regulators. The Federal Reserve's interested. The SEC, Gary Gensler, is leading on this. I've spoken to the FDIC. I've spoken to OCC. I speak to Consumer Protection Bureau. All of them have some role in some part of crypto to bring them so that the investors are protected, consumers are protected, and the financial system overall is protected. So that's my responsibility as chair of the Banking Housing Committee. It's also SEC's and these other agencies' responsibility to step up as they are doing as a group, and I think in a pretty progressive, pretty direct way.
Senator Sherrod Brown, appreciate you joining us today, the Senate Banking Committee Chairman.
Welcome back. As we head into the third year of the pandemic, the U.S. is trailing other wealthy nations in containing COVID-related infections and deaths. A new report from the New York Times shows that U.S. COVID deaths per capita are the highest among peer high-income countries, and vaccinations have continued to lag. Our next guest joins us to discuss this and more. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel is University of Pennsylvania Vice Provost of Global Initiatives, as well as former White House Health Policy Advisor. Dr. Emanuel, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. As I was mentioning, the U.S. has certainly been trailing its peers in its pandemic response. What do you think were the crucial missteps that got us to the point that we're at now?
Well, I think a large part of it can be attributed to the misinformation and the political polarization that hasn't allowed the country to get behind a unified approach. You know, when President Biden took over in January, he had a very good strategic plan, and they executed on the strategic plan. It was heavily focused on getting people vaccinated, which is critical to increasing the population immunity and ability to fight the virus. Because of misinformation, because of all sorts of lies that have been propagated out there, like it causes infertility or serious side effects. They're implanting chips in people's brains. I mean, crazy stuff. We've plateaued at about 60% of the population vaccinated. That's not good enough. And if there's one thing that could help, it would be that. It's not the only thing we need to do, but it's certainly a major problem, and that's has caused a major misstep.
And so the Supreme Court already pushed back against mandates against private or for private businesses, which stemmed from the White House trying to make those advancements. And so what is the next potential step that can be made on the mandate front to get to 70% or 80% of a vaccination rate in the U.S.?
Well, I think there are probably three places you can really look. One is you can mandate certain employers that have high risk situations, objectively, you know, food processor plants, other high risk environments like long-term care facilities, correctional facilities. I think that the Supreme Court is going to have to accept as critical and a targeted mandate. Second, there's travel, airplane travel, train travel. Those are interstate commerce. Interstate commerce is something the federal government has a legitimate power over. And the third, I think, is children in schools, where, you know, assistance and help with lots of things to schools can be linked to getting children, staff, and teachers vaccinated. So I think those are probably the three areas I would look at for expanding the numbers. In addition, getting boosters to the vulnerable, immunocompromised people, people over 65, those are very important as well.
You mentioned that vaccines and getting the vaccination rate up is just one part of the response that needs to be bolstered in the U.S. What else do you think needs to be done now here in the U.S., especially on the testing and masking fronts?
Well, first of all, I would say probably my second leading area is therapeutics. We have one therapy that's pretty effective and easy to administer. That's the Paxlovid drug, antiviral drug from Pfizer. It's in short supply, and one drug is not good because viruses will naturally mutate to neutralize that drug. So we need a multi-drug cocktail, and I think we need the equivalent of warp speed to develop that multi-drug cocktail. We have some other drugs. There's intravenous remdesivir, there's this monoclonal antibody, but we don't have lots of them and they're hard to give. And we also need to better connect people who test positive to get those drugs at the moment. That is not a smooth process and it's not available to all Americans. So that's probably my second top priority. And I think it's also very, very important to have tests that are ubiquitous and cheap, under $3 a throw, down from what, you know, we're paying now about $12.50 per test. And I think that's also a vital thing to do by getting more tests approved in the country, increasing the number, probably having the federal government negotiate prices down, and making those tests readily available almost everywhere. The other thing I think that is sort of would be behind the scenes, not create a lot of discomfort, is improving the indoor air quality to reduce transmission. We know that a lot of the transmission is on aerosols, those small particles in the air in indoor settings where people are close, air currents take the aerosols all around the room. Improving the quality, whether by HEPA filters or by improving the air filtration filters that are in the air conditioning and heating systems, absolutely critical, doesn't require a person to do anything to change their risk, but can dramatically reduce the risk of transmission, as well as other illnesses, other viruses, but also particulate matter in the air, like, you know, things that cause asthma.
Right. Doctor, if I remember correctly, the WHO had cast some doubt on remdesivir, and it really comes after they had done more long-term studies. And so how important is the improvement of long-term data reporting on everything from COVID side effects all the way to some of the very response mechanisms that we've started to put in place?
You are absolutely right. That is a very perceptive comment. And I would say it's not just things like long-term implications on remdesivir. We need better data on long COVID. We don't know its frequency. Numbers are all over the map. We have some recent data that suggests that, in fact, if you get a vaccine, you do better. And the question is, you know, if you get a vaccine soon after you get infected, does that help? A recent study actually out today or yesterday suggests that's very important. We need to also look at how long those side effects last. Do they go away? What proportion of people go away? We don't have that kind of long-term data. And it's a little surprising we don't have it, because we've known about long COVID for, you know, call it a year and a half. Half a year into COVID, we knew people were having persistent symptoms. We should have started big studies right then and there. And by a year later, 15 months later, we should have that, those kind of data.
Doctor, you have a recent op-ed in the New York Times discussing China's zero COVID policy. And in that, you write, to use your words, its pursuit of zero COVID will prove to be a huge mistake. The policy has left it wholly unprepared for what will become endemic COVID. Can you explain more of what you mean by this and how this could carry implications for the rest of the world?
We're not getting rid of COVID. It's going to be around. How bad it is, we don't know. But we do know that people who are not, don't have an immune response to COVID, so people who are unvaccinated or haven't been infected, they are at much higher risk of getting serious and severe consequences, being hospitalized and dying. And the Chinese, because their vaccines really don't work and because there hasn't been hardly any COVID in the country, do not have a very good population level immunity. And therefore, when Omicron spreads, it's much more dangerous, more sick people. And I think that's a real problem. To date, the way the Chinese have handled this is by just locking down tens of millions of people for weeks at a time. But when you have something as contagious and spreads as easily as Omicron, that is going to be like a whack-a-mole problem. Eventually, they're going to have to open up. Now, they don't want to do that quickly. They don't want to do that quickly because of the Winter Olympics, and they're going to great lengths to prevent people from spreading it who are in the Olympic bubble. And they don't want to do it ahead of the October Communist Party meeting when Xi is supposed to be elevated for a third term. And I think these are their considerations. You know, they're going to need a new vaccine if they're going to try to recognize endemic COVID, or they're going to end up sealing themselves off from the rest of the world and having these very severe Chinese style lockdowns, which are nothing like the lockdowns in the United States, that will be quite profound and quite damaging.
Doctor, we appreciate your insights on all of these topics. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel is University of Pennsylvania Vice Provost of Global Initiatives, as well as former White House Health Policy Advisor.
Candy giant Hershey is out with better than expected sales and earnings. The company also struck an upbeat outlook for profits this year, despite being in a very inflationary environment, just like many others in the packaged goods space. Joining us now is Hershey CFO Steve Voskhil. Steve, always nice to see you. Thanks for taking some time. We were in search of some good news in the markets today, and it's coming via Hershey. The results you put up today, does that reflect that we are have become even more a nation of snackers during the pandemic?
Well, we certainly have. You know, we're very pleased to finish the year on a strong note. There aren't many years where you have the opportunity to deliver double-digit top and bottom line growth, growth across all of our top 20 brands. I think average growth across that group of 12%, record cash flow, record production. So all in all, very pleased with where we finished. And yes, we are ever more a nation of snackers.
And Steve,
and
just
go ahead, Seth.
No, I was just going to follow up on that. It looks like you were able to push through price increases in the most recent quarter. How much have you been able to push through in terms of price?
Yeah, so over the course of last year, through a series of price increases, we've been able to take our whole portfolio up, mid to high single digits, depending on which part of the portfolio. We will take that benefit forward into 2022, and we're going to need it. You know, like many companies, we're facing the same sort of inflationary pressures across all the input costs that go into making Hershey and Reese's taste great.
Steve, it's Julie here. So when you look at those input costs, what do you see going forward? We know that costs have been going higher. What is this year going to look like? What kind of visibility do you have?
Yeah, we have pretty good visibility. We've got a hedging program. And as you'd imagine, with as much as we consume of some of our ingredients, we need to purchase those well in advance and have some long-term contracts in place. you know, across the commodity space, the areas where we're seeing some of the biggest increases include sugar, dairy, nuts, specialty ingredients, and packaging materials. But if I step back and look more broadly, of course, we're seeing inflation in areas like labor and even services that are provided by third parties. When we look across all of those impacts for us, we see inflation pressures in the mid to high single digits for 2022.
What has surprised me, Steve, is that a lot of retailers have been working down their inventories in many product lines, and that has impacted the packaged goods space. Any signs that might alleviate this year? And you'll see the likes of a Walmart and Target rebuilding how much stuff they stock in the stores.
Yeah, we believe it will. In fact, as we've contemplated our guidance for this year, we're assuming some level of build back of retailer and distributor inventory. Of course, we also need to build back some of our own inventory, but we're counting on some recovery. And that will allow us to get our customer service levels up higher and just do an even better job of serving our consumers.
Is Hershey more, should investors think of the company as a confectionery player or more increasingly as a salty goods player? You recently made that acquisition, $1.2 billion total of Dots Pretzels, that gets you into the pretzel space.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, more and more, we want to have that balance in our portfolio. We are, first and foremost, still a confection company built around those great brands that are our heritage. But several years ago, we began the first steps into building out that snacking portfolio on the savory side. And that includes the brands Skinny Pop and Pirate's Booty. And as you said, Brian, now Dots as well. And we're very excited about that part of our portfolio. It is seeing even more robust volume growth than we've seen on the confection side as people look for savory snacks as well as sweet snacks. And we look forward to seeing that portfolio continue to grow and expand and gain scale as we go through 2022.
Should note that Hershey shares are now at a record high after this quarter and outlook from you guys today. Lastly, Steve, I was reading an analyst note, and they said that you are expanding manufacturing for gummy products. What might you launch this year?
Yeah, so our Jolly Rancher gummy product has been doing great. We're going to launch some new flavors. One of those is called Very Berry. I have some in my desk. That will be one of the products that we bring out in the gummy space this year. And, you know, the sweet space and gummies in particular is a rapidly growing part of confection. And we want to continue to meet consumers' needs in that space.
Anything with caffeine, Steve?
Nothing with caffeine. Not
gotta ask. Gotta ask. All right. Just gotta ask for myself. Personal interest question. Hershey CFO, Steve Voskuil. Good luck this quarter. We'll talk to you soon.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance. I'm here with Ruth Porat, Chief Financial Officer of Alphabet. Ruth, nice to see you.
It's great to be with you.
So you're in Detroit today to announce a partnership with Ford as founding members of Michigan Central. What is Michigan Central and what will Google's role be?
So I am right here in an iconic building in Detroit, really excited to be here. What Michigan Central, what we're announcing today with the governor, the mayor of Detroit as well, is a comprehensive program really focused on digital skills and the future of work. When you think about it, Michigan was really at the forefront of the Industrial Revolution, and here the world is going through this digital transformation. And so what we're looking at is a comprehensive program. What Google is doing is bringing first and foremost our digital skills training program, Grow with Google. We're expanding that here in Michigan. Very excited about it. We offer training that leads to certificates in four high-growth job areas in IT support, data analytics, project management, and user experience. And what we've done is we've built out a consortium of more than 150 companies that will accept this certificate for these high-growth jobs. And anybody with no background experience in 3 to 6 months can get this training. Ford is a member of our consortium. So you go through the program, you can get a job at any of these 150-plus companies and welcome others to join the consortium as well. So one is digital skills training. The second here in Michigan Central is we'll be offering hands-on training and mentorship for high school students. Tragically, about 50% of high schools do not offer CS training in school, and yet that's where the jobs of the future are. And so we're providing skills training here at Michigan Central. And then very excited with Ford, this will be the home for a research and focused effort around the future of mobility and where that can go. And Google Cloud is a partner with Ford were the exclusive partner for the effort here at Michigan Central and looking at what is the future of mobility.
You mentioned there's a job creation component here, a STEM education element. What is the significance of the program at a moment when we're seeing job openings at near record highs?
So when I think about it, we view this as an opportunity and a responsibility. There are jobs that are exciting, high growth, rewarding jobs. People need to have the skills for those jobs. And in order to have sustainable growth in the economy, we need to have inclusive growth. And so our program is designed really to reach out to everyone to make these jobs available and accessible. One thing we're really proud of at Google is that we are really opening the doors and reaching into diverse underrepresented communities in the technology sector. So training in the Black community, Hispanic, with women, with veterans, and really opening doors to so many people to these exciting jobs of the future.
Ruth, does this partnership with Ford reflect a deeper strategic relationship that might extend to, say, Waymo or other endeavors?
So, as I mentioned, Ford has been a partner with us, a cloud partner of Google's, and we're doing quite a bit of work with them through Google Cloud and through Android Auto as well. And so that was the nexus of a conversation with Bill Ford and Ford Motor Company about what could we see here at Michigan Central, and how can we do something that really does benefit people across Michigan and really sets a model for what is public-private partnership. Excited to have the governor and the mayor of Detroit here with us, because it is about public-private partnership. And our view is that the way to have the greatest impact is where you can bring the private sector, the public sector, you can bring together a consortium, as I described with our Grow with Google certificate program, and really amplify the work of any one company. And so that's what we're looking at, is how can we do more here? And yes, with Ford, we're doing quite a bit of work in a number of different areas.
I want to shift gears a little bit and ask you about the business. You announced strong earnings this week. Also, a 20-for-1 stock split, which I've got to ask you about. Take us inside that decision. Explain why now, why 20-for-1? You guys have a bit of an unusual capital structure with a few classes of shares. Talk to us about that, Ruth.
So the thought around a 20-for-1 stocks, around a stock split, is that we heard from some shareholders that it would actually make access to shares more accessible. And so as we thought about it, our view was that it made sense to come up with a split that took the stock price into a zone that would be more accessible for more people. And the response has been positive. There's gratitude for those who are looking at it saying, yes, this does make it easier for me, or as I think about my parents or my kids. The math of it is, if would I rather have a dollar or four quarters, you could say it's the same thing. That being said, it does make the shares more accessible to some. And so we decided it was the appropriate thing to do.
Right. One of the big headwinds in the stock market right now is higher interest rates and potential rate hikes. Should investors be worried about that when it comes to owning growth stocks, and in particular, Google?
So I will leave the stock recommendations to those in that field. I would say that, at the end of the day, our job is to focus on a performance and what we can do to create ever better, ever more helpful products. And as I've said, when I was a banker and every day in this role, if we do the right thing and we focus on doing the right thing, the stock price will follow. So I will leave it to others to do the prognostication. But at the end of the day, what we're looking at is delivering high quality products that are ever more helpful, ever more useful. And that drives the types of performance we were able to talk about on our earnings call.
Final question, Ruth. You mentioned Google Cloud. Revenue grew 45% in the last quarter, year over year. You still are behind, I guess, Amazon and Microsoft as well. Where have you seen success, and what are the impediments to moving this business forward?
So we are continuing to invest aggressively in Google Cloud, because we do think that companies are just in the early stages of their transformation, digital transformation, and moving to the cloud. And where we're seeing really strong success, and you can see it in the numbers, is the partnership with customers across industries focused on their digital transformation. They're leveraging our data analytics our AI, our ML, our industry-specific solutions. And so what we've been focused on doing is investing in our go-to-market effort and the products that our customers need so that we can continue with them on their journey. And really pleased with the leadership of Thomas Kurian, the momentum in that business. You can see it in the results and continuing to invest given what we see ahead.
All right, Ruth Porat, CFO of Google. Stay warm out there. Thanks so much for joining us.